The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
I think the U.S. system offers two big strategic threats to Russia. One is the U.S. as the leader of the Western world, the leader of NATO, its alliances with its European allies around Russia's periphery make Russia feel very encircled and nervous. But the second thing, and more importantly, it's the American system of openness and transparency, of accountable government, that really threatens some of the things that Evelyn was talking about with the corruption, with the like questioning their lack of fortune, things like that. The U.S. poses an alternative governance system, which makes Putin's very nervous. So they are very uncomfortable with pro-democracy activists. They're uncomfortable with opposition. So they try and weaken our system so that we cannot weaken their system.
And they do see those demonstrations, things that we would call normal democratic processes. So in Ukraine, for example, where the Ukrainian people got sick of their corrupt government and basically demanded a new government, demanded new elections. Putin sees those things as engineered from the outside.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 15th, 2017. It's widely accepted that Russia interfered in the 2016 presidential election, but what should the United States actually do about it? Mika Ouyang and Evelyn Farkas, co-authors of a new paper on the subject at Third Way, with Ben Freeman and Gary Ashcroft, sat down with Benjamin Wittes to chat about their proposals in their paper, titled The Last Straw, Responding to Russia's Anti-Western Aggression. This interview is actually in two parts. We recorded the first segment, which you'll hear second, last week before the G20 summit and President Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin. Then, this week, we reconnected with Mika and Evelyn for a brief update on the news coming out of the G20. You'll hear this segment first. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 238, Mika Ouyang and Evelyn Farkas on holding Russia accountable for election interference.
So we're going to do this a little bit out of order because we had a long conversation last week in which we talked at length about the report that you guys have put out on Russia. And since we had that conversation, there has been, shall we say, news on the Trump-Russia front. The first element of which was that Trump and Putin sat down together and had a really nice long conversation with very few other people present at the G20. And then just as the president was coming back, this whole thing about his son and Paul Manafort and Jared Kushner meeting with a representative of the Russian government, lawyer representative, for purposes of collecting dirt on Hillary Clinton, has in a cascade of endlessly fascinating news stories come to light. So, Mika and Evelyn, before we play the discussion that we had last week about your report, let's just situate it in terms of the events that have happened in the last week and a half. What bring us up to speed and about how the work that you've done fits in with this kind of complicated and difficult to get your hands around set of news stories.
Yeah, so I'll go ahead and start and then Evelyn can fill in. But this meeting between Putin and Trump on the sidelines of the G20 was the first time that those leaders had had a chance to meet face to face since the election and since we've learned all of this information about what the Russians were trying to do to interfere in the election to make sure that Trump was the president instead of Hillary Clinton. And many people expected that the president of the United States, or hoped that the president of the United States would be tough on Putin in defense of our electoral system, in defense of our democracy, and said that he really had to take it to Putin and demonstrate real consequences for interfering with our most sacred right, how we choose our leaders. And unfortunately, that didn't happen. What happened in the meeting was a lot of talk. They were separated from normal government officials on either side, so it was just the presidents or the leaders and their two foreign ministers or secretaries of state. So we're not sure exactly what happened in that meeting, but what came out of that was less than I think most foreign policy folks would have liked to see.
And if I could add to that, I think the one word to encapsulate the issue at stake here is transparency. We didn't have transparency in the meeting, as Mika just outlined, because we didn't have a full press conference with a detailed readout that you would get if it was someone other than the Secretary of State giving the readout, which in the past has been the senior director responsible for that region of the world. So there was transparency missing from that meeting. And I think for the U.S. government itself, there was also transparency missing, unless great notes were taken by the Secretary of State, and I guess I doubt that. The other issue, the Donald Trump Jr. issue, clearly there also we need to have greater transparency. And, you know, whether it's shoring up the campaign finance laws, whether it's doing an education overhaul. So I think the main point I want to make is that the recommendations, the bulk of our recommendations have to do with increasing transparency. And then the other side is, of course, enforcement if there's insufficient transparency and wrongdoing.
One of the things that Trump did say was going to come out of this meeting, aside from a ceasefire in Syria that no one seems to be able to monitor, was that he said that he would work with the Russians on cybersecurity to try and prevent future election hacking,
but then
he reversed himself, and it was sort of a ridiculous thing. But then what we saw today coming out of the president's meeting with Macron in France was that Macron has agreed to work with the U.S. on election interference and cybersecurity, and that is actually the much more appropriate country to be working with on these issues, because the French actually had Russian interference happen in their election as well.
Well, so clearly one leader has been reading your report. It's just not our leadership. So with that, let's turn to the discussion of the work you guys did. I don't want to relitigate the whole question of to what extent Russia interfered with the election or whether Russia's a bad actor on a sort of range of overseas matters, because my feeling is our listeners probably have already accepted a lot of the premise here. But I do want to start with a kind of brief overview of the factual predicate of the set of recommendations that you've made. You start with a lengthy section entitled The Case Against Russia. So, Mika, get us started. What's the case against Russia?
So when you're talking about the case against Russia, it's what they did in our election. A lot of people have forgotten largely how bad Russia was in the Cold War, but there are a number of things that they do as a country to actually undermine democratic integrity across Europe and in the U.S. that we think need to be responded to. There are a number of ways in which Russia works with criminal enterprises, hackers, to compromise American data, to steal our secrets and our money. There are a number of ways in which they are spreading fake news. And there are a number of ways in which they are taking advantage of the openness of our society in order to influence the ways that Americans themselves think about the elections. And that includes things like hiring lobbyists or paying former U.S. military officials to work with them, and also using their financial influence to get closer to various U.S. business people. And so when you look at the case that we've seen intelligence officials testify to about how Russia did what it did, not that all of that is out yet, we thought it was important to start responding to some of those things and look at areas where members of Congress, policymakers could actually take constructive steps to try and stop Russia from dealing with the problem again.
Okay, so Just to clarify, though, there are a lot of bad cyber actors out there, and there are a lot of authoritarian countries that do things in neighboring countries that we don't like. So you're proposing, before we get to what you're proposing a set of pretty robust steps against Russia. And my question is Russia qualitatively different from in the cyber domain from China, where, you know, a year and a half ago, we were all talking about China as the principal bad cyber actor, right? And in the authoritarian kind of like, we don't like the way they treat their neighbors, is it really different from a lot of other countries that, menace their neighbors? I mean, we have, you know, a blockade right now of Qatar by a bunch of our Gulf allies. So as a sort of predicate threshold question, how different is Russia here, and what are the pivots that actually make it different from other actors that we're not proposing significant actions against?
So I'll take a quick stab at that and then turn it over to Evelyn, my co-author on this. But there are a couple of ways in which Russia is qualitatively different than other countries. The first is that China engages in espionage in an information gathering sense. A lot of the Chinese hacks that we saw that were nation state sponsored were about gathering information on our national security professionals. That's qualitatively different than Russia, which has this army of what Putin calls patriotic hackers that engage in compromising people's email accounts and information to be able to steal money, but then work hand in glove with the Russian intelligence services who come along behind them and then use that to gather information. It's the combination of it's a nation state hacking combined with this lack of respect for the rule of law and for playing in the economy on the up and up. And that there, the merging of the criminal enterprise and the national security enterprise, is what makes Russia qualitatively different than other countries.
But I think there's a bigger thing going on here, Ben, because what Mika is describing, this Russian government cooperation or collaboration with cyber criminals, is not new. And the FBI knows about this. They've been going slowly after these cyber criminals. In fact, they wanted to do more. In 2000, they recognized this was going to be a problem, the intersection between and the collaboration between the mafia world, the underworld, and the Russian government. But then 9/11 happened. So now they're going to have to pivot and do more, and hopefully Congress will give them more resources. But the problem we have with Russia is that this, as Mika said, this is a government that not only takes the information, but now we've seen them weaponize it. And now we see that we have a president in place in Russia that not only is behaving in an anti-status quo way in Europe and elsewhere, but that this government is willing to take risks and to take political action, political warfare against the United States in a way that we haven't seen since the Cold War.
Yeah, so it seems to me that that distinction is really important, that when we finally responded in a significant way to Chinese cyber attacks, it was on the basis not of the theft of the information, but on the basis of the commercialization of that information for its own businesses, right? And it was really, we reserved the right to hack, but we said, it's the use of hacking to advantage domestic commercial firms at the expense of foreign competitors that makes this different. And here it seems to me what really makes this different is the weaponization of the information through cutout organizations like WikiLeaks, in an effort to affect political cultures of other countries. And I think there's nothing new.
Or political outcomes.
Right. But I mean, like, you know, if it were just a question of hacking political organizations, we famously hacked Angela Merkel when she was, her cell phone, when she was an opposition leader. There's sort of nothing new under the sun in that
regard. Yeah, spying is normal.
So from your all's point of view, if Russia would limit itself to the theft of the information, they'd be kind of within the bounds. It's the release of the information that makes it different.
Correct. And I think we first saw this towards the United States, being used towards the United States in 2014, when the Russians, we know, through their cooperation with the Ukrainian secret police, obtained a recording of a phone conversation between Victoria Nuland, who was then Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, between Victoria Nuland and our ambassador to Ukraine at the time, Jeff Pyatt. And in that recording, she used a swear word that begins with an F and then said F the European Union, the EU. Now, it was in the context of a conversation. I don't want to get into the details of it, but that was the first time where we saw the Russians take some recorded spy conversation, basically, and release it to the public to use it against the United States to create a rift, to try to create a rift between us and our EU allies.
Because it is so shocking that a U.S. diplomat would say, fuck the EU. I mean, that no one in the EU...
not on the record, normally.
No one in the EU had ever imagined that such words could be spoken by an EU diplomat. Okay, so let's go to the question of why it is in Russia's strategic interest to behave this way, because a lot of your policy recommendations are a response to an effort to change Russia's perceptions of its strategic interests. But look, normally when people spy, it's to do things with information. It's to inform policymaking. This seems to me to be an expression of Russia's generally weak hand to play in the international arena, that, you know, you can't, they're not in a position simply go to other states and say, hey, here's what we have to offer, here's what the absence of our cooperation might mean for you, you make your own decisions, here's the basis on which we'd like to do business. They have to, you know, do what they euphemistically call active measures, which effectively amounts to sort of, you know, dirty tricks in the covert action space. And the question is, why are they behaving that way? How did they come to understand that as, you know, a good strategic mode for them to engage? And over what period of time did this develop as an area that we should be concerned about? I mean, it sort of exploded upon our consciousness in 2016, but it's actually not new, right?
Yeah. So if I can just quickly, because I hope to write a book about this, Ben, and then I can get into it in more length. But basically, this is, as you rightly pointed out, it's an asymmetric measure that Russia is taking. So this measure, meaning cyber attacks, hacking, releasing the information publicly, there's a whole nother dimension, which is the corruption, which we'll get into, because that gets into the dark, the lack of transparency, the dark money, etc. But what Russia is trying to do is weaken America, weaken our democracy through these asymmetric means, so that we are not a counter to them in Europe, in what they call their near abroad, so Eastern Europe, the former Soviet space, which also includes then Central Asia. Beyond that, they would like a free hand in Syria and elsewhere. The Russian government came to this is not a new realization, but they came to the realization that they had to push back against the United States because they felt that we were taking advantage of their weakness in the aftermath of the collapse of the Soviet Union. So there was about a decade where we called it the unipolar world order. I mean, the United States basically had the upper hand vis-a-vis Russia and any other state. That changed starting in 2000 with the rise of the oil prices and the change in Russian fortunes. The coffers began to get full, and the Russians got sick and tired of being weak on many fronts and having disorganized domestic situation, and Vladimir Putin came to the fore. So that's kind of as quick as I can, a summarization of how you got Vladimir Putin. And essentially, Putin came to power on a law and order platform with an economic mandate. And he told the Russians, you're going to get borscht in your bowl, if you will. You know, it's like the equivalent of the chicken in your pot. And in exchange, I'm going to create law and order. You're not going to question me too much about democracy and what our secret services are doing, because your lifestyle is going to get better. And that worked until about 2000, 11 or so, and Putin began to recognize that Putin and his cronies, and among them is former Prime Minister Medvedev. They transferred power from one to the other. Doesn't matter. Putin was basically the guy calling the shots. And when Putin began to see that this economic bargain wouldn't work because oil prices were going down, because the Russian economy was structured on this kind of feudal, corrupt system, it's very hard for the economy to innovate the way that ours can. So he realized that the economic realities meant that Russians were not going to be seeing more borscht in their bowl, if you will, over time, and maybe actually things would get tighter because the oil prices were going to go down. This all happened actually before the oil prices actually went down, before he invaded Ukraine. He recognized, okay, maybe I need to offer the Russians something else, the Russian people something else. So that's when he turned to nationalism. This, again, was already starting. And in his mind, of course, he was already a nationalist. But what he offered to the Russians now, very blatantly, starting in 2011, 2012, was, I'm going to make Russia great again.
I think the U.S. system offers two big strategic threats to Russia. One is the U.S. as the leader of the Western world, the leader of NATO, its alliances with its European allies around Russia's periphery make Russia feel very encircled and nervous. But the second thing, and more importantly, it's the American system of openness and transparency, of accountable government, that really threatens some of the things that Evelyn was talking about with the corruption, with the questioning their lack of fortune, things like that. The U.S. poses an alternative governance system, which makes Putin's very nervous. So they are very uncomfortable with pro-democracy activists. They're uncomfortable with opposition. So they try and weaken our system so that we cannot weaken their system.
And they do see those demonstrations, things that we would call normal democratic processes. So in Ukraine, for example, where the Ukrainian people got sick of their corrupt government and basically demanded a new government, demanded new elections. Putin sees those things as engineered from the outside. He doesn't see them as legitimate, and he doesn't see them at all the way we see them. And that's why for him, something like what happened in Ukraine is almost a direct threat to his legitimacy and to his future at the helm of Russia.
And the protests that happened in Moscow, which we publicly encouraged, are a particular affront, right?
The ones that happened right when he was coming to power again in 2011-12 happened as a result of elites in Moscow and St. Petersburg being unhappy with the transfer of power and his remaining in power and his cronies remaining in power. They weren't widespread. They weren't in every city and in every province. But nevertheless, he viewed them as a challenge to him. And he thought that our government was behind them because Secretary Clinton had put out a statement at the end of 2011 regarding the parliamentary elections, not his elections, not the presidential elections, saying that they, criticizing them for not being quite as free and fair as they should have been. Because in Russia, the reality is while they have elections, they are not free and fair. The people who can run for office, that's very controlled. And if it looks like Putin's going to lose, that's also controlled.
So why, before we get to the six specific things, I want to ask about a seventh thing that isn't on there. And I want to start with what you didn't suggest, which is, why shouldn't we steal a lot of information that would be highly embarrassing to Vladimir Putin and release it, right? You start with an assumption that we should be engaged in an asymmetric response. But why not do a symmetric response? You attack our political system by releasing material, stealing and releasing material that is embarrassing to our political system or that interferes with or gets involved. Oh, we're going to do exactly the same thing to you. Why not start with symmetry?
So one of the challenges with symmetry, and a lot of people who say, let's do what the Russians do, let's attack them on cyber, let's steal their secrets, let's interfere with Putin's elections, in some ways, getting us to descend to their tactics is part of what he needs. If the U.S. doesn't stand as an alternative system of governance, if we don't actually challenge Putin in different ways, then in some ways he's won, right? It's like when you like when the U.S. engages in tactics of torture, in some ways we are not the holding up the higher moral ground that the U.S. has done for years and for decades. It's why Soviet citizens and Russian citizens would risk their lives to spy on their own government on behalf of the U.S., because we offered something different. It wasn't just a question of payment. It wasn't a question of, like, threats. There was this idealism to it. And if we are no better than Putin, we lose that.
And I would add that the premise, I think our going in premise was, what can we do to strengthen ourselves, strengthen our allies, and move not offensively against Russia, but sort of proactively for the United States. And so we're just shoring up our system. We have a really good, strong, as you know, your whole, you know, bread and butter is on based on our legal system and making it better and, you know, looking at it. We believe we have a strong legal system. We just have to strengthen it, reinforce it, use it better. And so that was our approach. It was very much aimed at our own front yard and our backyard.
All right. So with that as a wind up, walk us through the 6-part plan for peace and prosperity.
Okay. Well, so we had categories. We don't actually want to tell Congress, and we should just remind the people listening, this is aimed mainly at lawmakers at Congress. You know, they're the ones who need, they laid down the law already, but some of the laws are weak, some of the laws are non-existent, and so we're giving them some direction, but we're not spelling out exactly what they should do. And we also, in the body of our report, talk about certain proposals that have already been put out by lawmakers. So again, we're not trying to pick favorites. And we're certainly not picking between Republicans and Democrats either. So the first category is sanctions, prosecutions, and cybersecurity. So here, what we're getting at is the existing sanctions that are on the books, let's make them stronger. And let's make sure that they also apply to corrupt activities. And we consider things like secondary sanctions. Included in here is also, I said prosecution, so enforcement. The Treasury Department has obviously laws that they need to enforce, but they don't necessarily have the means to do so. They need more people. They could definitely use a task force. We do specifically recommend a task force on financial crimes, which is aimed specifically at Russia and enforcing the laws that are in place right now. And obviously this will need to be funded and resourced properly. We also believe strongly that we need cyber education, investigation, and attribution. And specifically here, we do make one specific recommendation, which dovetails nicely actually with a recent Washington Post op-ed by Michael Chertoff talking about election security. And so we talk about the need for a new office for election integrity in the Treasury Department. The second basket of recommendations is on international transparency. So here, this is getting at what I mentioned earlier, the dark money. We need to make sure that we can determine ownership of entities that are coming in and investing in the United States, that are buying our properties. We even suggest a CFIUS process, so the committee that does the oversight of foreign acquisitions, that they look at Russian acquisitions. And there are too many entities coming in and buying things in the United States, you know, kind of doing offshore money laundering, if you will, in the United States from other countries. We want to break that down. We want to eliminate that. So the second basket, as I said, is international transparency. Then there's domestic transparency, which is really looking at money laundering in the U.S., strengthening laws, not just at the federal level, but at the state level. And then the fourth bucket is foreign agent transparency. So here we get at the Paul Manafort issue, whereby someone can go overseas, provide advice to a foreign government, but that doesn't necessarily get captured by our existing laws. So we want that to be tightened, and I think Congress is already working on that. But it also has to do with foreign entities coming here and spending money to influence our political dynamic. And here we specifically point to RT, which is the Russian media network, which is not an independent media network, you know, like NBC. It's actually owned, paid for, and controlled by the Russian government. The fifth category is public-private partnership. So here, basically, it means let's work with companies like Facebook, Twitter, all these companies that are dealing with the propaganda and the fake news. Let's try to have Congress work with them to basically get them to police the internet better so that American citizens are not subjected unknowingly to fake information. If they're going to have to look at fake information, then Facebook and Twitter and other companies should have to label it or something like that. And when I say should have to, it doesn't mean that it has to be legislated. A partnership can be one that's voluntary, or it can be one that is required by law. The sixth one is strengthening allies. So here, this gets to really working with all of our allies, first and foremost, of course, our NATO allies. And there we make a recommendation for a cyber operations center because, look, at the end of the day, an attack against the United States or any other country that's a cyber attack can actually be just as serious as an attack using troops, because if you take out the electric grid and hospitals can't, you know, see to their patients, et cetera, that can have the same kind of impact as launching a Tomahawk missile into a hospital. And basically, that gives you the sense of the buckets, and we can go into the details if you like.
All right. So let's start with strengthening sanctions. There's Senate passed legislation on this with respect to both Russia and Iran. And so my first question is that roughly what you had in mind, or for the part that involves new sanctions, is that what you guys had in mind? But secondly, I'm broadly and more sort of thematically, I'm interested in the question of who should be subject to sanctions, who isn't now. We already have some sanctions against Russia. So if you're going to strengthen them, presumably it means there's a bunch of types of transactions that are currently allowed that in your all's world wouldn't be allowed. And so I'm trying to imagine what the universe of that sanctions and that those prohibited transactions look like.
Right. So part of the challenge with the congressional legislation is that President Obama imposed some sanctions, and those were specific on individuals who they were concerned were involved in the interference. But those are executive branch sanctions, so those can be done away with by the president very easily. The Senate legislation is in part to codify those things so that President Trump can't get rid of them with a handshake deal with Putin if that's the request out of the G20. That legislation has not yet passed the House, so at this point those are still fairly easy to turn off, and I think Congress has made very clear, the vote was like 98-2, that they would rather not have that happen. We had called for sanctions over and above what the Obama administration had done, and the Senate bill also looks to increase and say, are there additional sanctions that we can be looking at, in particular for Russians who are involved in cybersecurity? It may be that we need to take a look at some additional entities. There was the talk of DOD imposing a ban on the use of Kaspersky, which is a Russian cybersecurity company, which has been involved in Russian hacking before. There are financial services companies that looked at the energy sector, state-owned enterprises, and saying, okay, what is it exactly that we can crank up additional sanctions on Russia because there is some connection to this election interference. It's not everything, but the idea is that you would increase over and above what Obama did. The presumption was that the Obama administration, in looking at it, was really focused on the interference to the voting machines and was leaving it to the next administration to take on a much more robust approach. And unfortunately, we now have an administration who doesn't seem to be very interested in protecting the election integrity.
And I would just add to that, Ben, that the sanctions that were passed by the Senate and hopefully will be passed by the House and sent over to the White House, they are aimed mainly at codifying the existing sanctions, which, as you know, in the main are geared towards punishing Russia for what they did in Ukraine. They're just the small Obama-era sanctions that he put out at the end that had to do with the elections. Our report is geared completely towards the elections and, you know, making Russia pay a price for what they did to our elections and preventing them from doing something like that again. So it's not aimed at Ukraine and they're invading their neighbors.
So, but again, what's the universe of people that are not, if that's the policy objective, who are not subject to sanctions today, who, when the Farkas-Ouyang plan goes into effect, will find what sort of transactions that they want to engage in suddenly blocked.
So I think part of the challenge here is that as we gather more information on exactly what happened in the election, who the figures were that were tied to, you will turn up more and more individuals who had a hand in this, who, right, you see some of these Russian oligarchs who have had meetings with or were trying to influence things. Those individuals may come under scrutiny. And then when we see the Mueller report come back, there may be more people who are engaged in criminal enterprises that had an election nexus that we would want to see sanctioned in those instances. But right now, we don't have the entire factual basis, so I couldn't give you a list of names. Evelyn and I are both now out of government, so we don't have access to that information anymore. But given the amount of scrutiny that's coming into exactly what Russia did, we would expect that there's a longer list of people who would be involved in these activities, who you'd want to say, I'm sorry, you don't get the benefit of doing business with the United States anymore.
Yeah, we're trying to clamp down in this report on the cyber criminals, the people who are investing money. Maybe the money is even making its way into our political system, but we don't know it. So without specifically saying who we're targeting in this report, we say what we're targeting. What are the problems that we see? We see a lack of transparency. There's insufficient transparency. There are people who are working in the system from overseas or from the United States with overseas actors who are not being held accountable. And so we're trying to also shed light, if nothing else. But then, of course, obviously, we would like people to pay a price.
Right. But it's not just about the sanctions. And that's why the transparency prosecutions piece goes along with that, because Russia doesn't succeed in these activities unless they have complicit partners in the United States or in the country that they're targeting. So the question then becomes, who in our country was not fulfilling their obligations to disclose foreign connections? We've already seen some of this information with General Flynn, people failing to disclose contacts with the Russians in their security clearance forms, the financial connections that may come with Paul Manafort and others. There are individuals there that you need to actually say, okay, you had an obligation to report your connections. You didn't do that. Those statutes actually allow for enforcement, and we haven't done that yet.
So, okay, it seems to me you have three kind of buckets of transparency. You have what you called international transparency, you have domestic transparency, and then you have this FARA category. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me the second two categories are substantially more promising than the first, right? The as you describe the international transparency, well, it involves maybe a new treaty, which is a years-long process to negotiate, let alone get ratified. And then it involves stepped up FCPA enforcement, which is, you know, that's a really powerful instrument. But it's also a domestic statute. So I'm not really sure what separates your world of international transparency from your world of domestic transparency.
On the international transparency piece of it, part of it is going around to our NATO partners, some of whom are very much incentivized to do this, and say, okay, are your domestic laws about your own interference with your foreign interference with elections strong enough? What examples can we help you provide with our own statutes?
Yeah, because we did such a great job with this.
Well, right? It's a common problem, and we're all facing it together. So, you know,
well, and the other thing is if other countries are more lax when it comes to cracking down on foreign corrupt practices, which we already hear from our business community. I mean, they don't like the FCPA because other countries don't have to abide by it. So if we work with our allies and hold their feet to the fire and help them recognize that it's in their interest to also cut back on corruption, these are the same allies who are competing with us, frankly, in some places.
So you're imagining, when you talk about the foreign side of transparency, you're imagining a group of countries who've all experienced this to one degree or another, or who have reasons to fear it, you know, thinking collectively, not necessarily in treaty form, but how can we all better inoculate ourselves and be a little bit more like France and a little bit less like the United States in our response to, you know, active measures?
That's right. And all of these Western governments are experiencing that, the support to far-right parties, right? To what extent are their parties getting foreign assistance or working with other governments? It is a common problem across a lot of these countries. And one of the real challenges for our NATO allies is, to what extent are these countries slowly slipping away from the values on which the alliance was founded, which is that there is democracy, there is an acceptance of a certain amount of dissent, that the people will decide. That kind of Western liberalism is really under assault across the continent.
So on the domestic side, it seems to me there's a lot of very promising raw material to work with, because I think you guys are exactly right that FARA is a weird instrument, because on the one hand, its substantive requirements are quite broad and quite robust, and on the other hand, the enforcement of it is quite weak, and its terms are actually relatively vague as to the sort of thing that Manafort did. The paper was written before he then turned around and registered, but you know, the curious thing about his registration is that he actually most of the work that he did was not obviously material that you need to register under FARA for, because he was working for Yanukovych in Ukraine for Ukrainian domestic politics. And so I think of it, it's a weird instrument, because on the one hand, it's really robust, but it has these big holes, and we don't enforce it in a significant way. And so My question is, how much of the problem, if you created the sort of mother of all FARAs, right, that really covered the universe of activities that we would want disclosed, and you resourced the enforcement of it properly, how much of the problem, it wouldn't address the problem of stealing information and releasing it to a shadowy organization abroad, but it might address substantially a lot of the problem of people who have these very peculiar Turkish representation relations, Russian relations, Ukrainian relations surrounding a presidential campaign and kind of functioning as its bread and butter. And so how much of the problem, in your all's view, is a FARA problem?
I don't think it's just a FARA problem. I think the weak enforcement of FARA is a challenge. I think there's also there's sort of a philosophic orientation problem, where people didn't see that kind of being beholden to foreign governments as problematic to engage in national security around a president. But part of democracy is about accountability and saying the voters can decide for themselves if they know all the information. And so increasing transparency, increasing reporting requirements under FARA would allow you to see which advisors to a presidential candidate were, in fact, working on behalf of foreign governments and had those interests. We saw a little bit of that in the transition. We talked about Bob Dole and his relationship to the Taiwanese. But that can be disclosed, and then people can take a look at the policy and feel like, decide whether or not it was influenced or not. Is it still in the American interest or not in the American interest? That doesn't get at the whole problem, because, again, as I said before, the Russians won't succeed at this unless they have people in the host nation who see advantage in doing so and actually help them to direct the weaponization of information. It's very sophisticated. They can't just do it by themselves. And so you need to know who those people are. And then you can make further determinations, once you know that, about whether or not they're really crossing a line into something that feels like more than just representation and maybe is harmful to the security interests of the U.S.
So we're running low on time, but I don't want to let you guys go without asking, how much of this can you do without the cooperation of the President of the United States? Because there is this one guy who, let's go through, I don't think has a particular interest in strengthening sanctions either against Russian actors for helping him get elected president, or enforcing those sanctions more actively, who's probably not interested in greater international transparency to show the degree of, you know, active measures that are affecting other democratic cultures in the way that they may have aided him, who surely does not want greater domestic transparency or reform of FARA to show how beholden some of his even current top aides were to foreign interference, who's probably not that interested in public-private partnerships to out the sort of fake news that really aided him, and who's made it really clear that strengthening alliances, including alliances, especially alliances with more robustly democratic countries, is just not high on his agenda. So it seems to me you've drafted a six-part agenda that, in almost any other presidency I could imagine, you could rely on the executive branch as a sort of principal ally. But every element of this strikes me as requiring an override of a presidential veto. And so I'm interested in the question, how much of this is in the land of, you know, alternative world fantasy, or maybe in a somewhat different political climate, these are the defensive measures that we need to put in place. And how much of do you see as politically realistic in the current climate?
Well, I think it's realistic within the congressional climate. Although, as you rightly point out, or at least you imply, you know, Congress is really good at blocking the president. Congress is really bad at making the executive branch do things. We know that. I know that from, well, we know that from watching the Ukraine dynamic under President Obama, whereby Congress wanted President Obama, gave President Obama authorization and money to buy lethal defensive weapons for Ukraine, and yet President Obama opted not to do so. So in this context, yes, it's true. Congress can pass a law. You know, it can actually be veto-proof, perhaps, but the president might opt not to actually implement it in full. Now the courts could do something about it. The bureaucrats could do something about it. It's, you know, I think it's part of the way our democracy works. You have different branches of power, and ultimately the American people and Congress will speak again. There'll be another election.
I think that's right. I think that a fair number of the transparency pieces of legislation could actually get enacted into law, that there's enough bipartisan support. The Senate voting 98-2 on the sanctions bill shows there's a strong support for taking additional action. So you can get some of these things enacted, but as Evelyn says, enforcement is hard. That said, Congress's own bully pulpit to start having the conversation among European allies, to travel abroad, to work on international transparency in the collective is still fairly strong, as is their ability to try and motivate the private sector to work on ways to stop fake news, right? They haven't even started hearings on that. There are a lot of things that could get moved by showing that the political will is there across a broad swath of America.
Mika, Evelyn, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. As ever, our music is performed by Sophia Gann. If you haven't already, please support the podcast by spreading the word and giving us a rating and review in the iTunes store. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.